podcast.
This is the National Gallery podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this episode with the great 16th century Venetian master Titian. You may have heard in the news about the National Gallery's recent joint acquisition with the National Galleries of Scotland of Titian's masterpiece Diana and Callisto. While opening this month, the gallery is also playing host to the painter's very first large-scale masterpiece, his Flight into Egypt. Its arrival is much anticipated, not least because the picture hasn't been seen outside of Russia since 1768, the year it was bought by Catherine the Great. Before the exhibition opened, Leah Caribbean met up with the gallery's senior curator of 16th century Italian painting, Carol Platzotta, to find out more about the picture and the young Titian.
Carol, Titian's Flight into Egypt was painted around 1506-7 when the artist was still a teenager, which is remarkable enough in itself. But I think what's first going to strike people when they come to see the painting is its size. I mean, it's well over 3 metres across. Could you take us through it?
Well, the size is impressive, certainly. It is the first large-scale painting that Titian actually painted, and it was probably for the porch of a Venetian palace. The subject of the picture is the flight of the Holy Family from Egypt. Of course, King Herod had decreed that all the baby children, male children, should be killed in order to avoid a rival being born. The painting shows Mary with the infant Jesus on a donkey. They're processing through the countryside, and Joseph follows along behind. One of the touching things that Titian has achieved is to create a very human scene in which Mary cradles the infant Jesus. She is supporting him in a sling, very much like a mother would carrying her baby around today. And you can see that she is holding the child in a very gentle maternal fashion.
Now, tell us about this extraordinary, very luscious landscape. I mean, it really doesn't look much like the Holy Land to me. There's an awful lot of greenery here.
Titian absolutely loved the countryside in which he himself was born, and you can get a little glimpse of that in the background where those mountain peaks are evident in silhouette on the horizon. Those are the mountains of Cadore, and indeed it's been established that that was actually a view that he could have seen from his own window when he was a boy.
That's absolutely beautiful. And in front of that view, in front of those mountains, I suppose almost half of the picture is taken up with all these wonderful animals in the foreground.
Yes, it really is almost tapestry-like, but in a very natural sort of way. So Titian has included this wonderful bullock, a little deer with his snout in the air as though he's sniffing the breeze, a hawk, and a fox who's come to look at the goings-on. I think that Titian wanted to show that all of nature was sort of benign around this Holy Family in Exodus.
Now, this exhibition not only shows us this fantastic picture, but also puts Titian's early works in context. There are several early Titians, but there are also some other works as well. Could you tell us a bit about that?
The aim of the exhibition is to put this painting, Titian's earliest masterpiece, in the context of the very fertile atmosphere that prevailed in Venice around 1500. We have Bellini, who by then was quite an old man, but he himself had been a great lover and painter of landscapes, and especially light. And Titian was a young boy in his workshop, and therefore learnt an enormous amount about how to introduce landscape into subject pictures, and especially for Bellini, devotional paintings. Then another important character in the show is Giorgione, who was also a pupil in Bellini's shop. And Giorgione was really the original painter of mystical landscapes, and the young Titian certainly learnt a lot from him as well. The third strand of the exhibition is Dürer, who visited Venice twice in this crucial first decade of the 16th century, and what he contributed to the story was an amazing eye for actual botanical details. There's a beautiful watercolour in the exhibition of two spring woodland flowers, the lily of the valley and the bugle. and they're just so beautifully depicted, very much as one would see even in an English woodland today.
There's going to be a lot of Titian this year at the gallery, isn't there? There's going to be another big exhibition of his later works in the summer. And there's also the wonderful new acquisition of Diana and Callisto already on show, and that's going to be there till July. And I was just wondering what insights this wonderful early work gives us into the artist that Titian was going to become.
What's marvellous about the picture is that it contains the seeds of so much that Titian was to become famous for. For example, these wonderful panoramic skies, the landscape, and above all, the humanity of the figures. One element that I really love in the picture is that the donkey is being led by this enigmatic young boy, not much older or younger than Titian was at the time he painted this. Many people have interpreted this figure as an angel, but he has no wings. So really, he could just be a young shepherd boy, or even just a symbol of Titian himself, leading us into this magical realm that he has created.
Thanks to Carol Platzotter. We'll have lots more news about Titian in future episodes. He's also the star of our big summer exhibition. But until then, if you'd like to see Titian's first masterpiece for yourself, The Flight into Egypt will be on display at the gallery from the 4th of April. Admission is free. And if you're visiting, don't forget to pop into Room 1, where Titian's Diana and Callisto, the recently purchased masterpiece, will be on show until the end of June. Now to our other current exhibition, Turner-inspired In the Light of Claude. This show explores the lifelong fascination of the 19th century British painter J.M.W. Turner for the work of the 17th century master of Italianate landscapes Claude Lorraine. Mary Griffiths caught up with exhibition curator Ian Worrell to find out how Turner's relationship with Claude's work developed over time, with particular reference to Tivoli, Tobias and the Angel, an imposing work by Turner which sets a biblical encounter in a luminous Italian landscape. Mary began by asking Ian how the young Turner would have initially encountered Claude's work.
Turner came from relatively humble backgrounds. His father was a barber in Covent Garden, and from that background, Turner was able to find connections with aristocratic patrons, first of all by showing drawings in his father's shop and through the exhibitions at the Royal Academy. And it was that access to these private homes, either in London or at the country houses, where these great paintings that were brought back from the Grand Tour were displayed. And Turner would have seen paintings by Poussin, Claude, as well as Titian. And these things were all the kind of benchmarks that he tested himself against. But it was above all Claude, as this great landscape painter, that he really admired and hoped to equal. And it wasn't just Turner who felt like that. I think there was still a very kind of conservative mindset about what contemporary art should be. I think patrons like Sir George Beaumont, whose collection is part of the founding collection here at the National Gallery, encouraged young artists to paint imitations of Claude or other 17th century artists because they felt that that was the most appropriate thing, and they wanted new art to be able to sit easily alongside traditional things. But Turner kind of questions that in his own painting. He felt that he and his generation were able to do something new, and he didn't like the idea of being limited in the way. He wanted to show that he could equal historic art, but to go beyond it as well.
How did Turner go about trying to surpass the achievements of Claude, in particular in a painting like this one, Tivoli, Tobias and the Angel?
I think when Turner was looking at Claude, the thing he most admired was Claude's ability to give a sense of the special character of a lighting effect. And when you walk around this exhibition again and again, you find that Turner is introducing amazing bursts of light, that the light is radiant and transcendent again and again as you walk around. But in this picture of Tivoli, it's an unfinished picture, and Turner's evolving the composition here very much along the same lines as Claude's typical compositions. And he's even got as far as introducing a narrative from the Bible of Tobias and the Angel. But he hasn't taken it to the full development. But the key thing he has already created is this wonderful sense of saturated sunlight. The canvas is just drenched in this warm Italian yellow light.
This is an Italian scene, and Turner didn't make it to Italy until his 40s. But this was a long-cherished dream of his. What was it that inspired him, that drove him to want to go to Italy?
I think so many artists of Turner's generation had longed to go to Italy, but for Turner, it was Claude was very much the driving force. in the end, his journey to Italy took him to Venice first of all, and you'd think most artists would have wanted to linger there, but not Turner. He probably stayed a maximum of 4 or 5 days because he was overwhelmed by the desire to get to the countryside that had inspired Claude. And as he's approaching Rome, he's adding in his notebooks comments like the first bit of Claude or another bit of Claude. So he was constantly on the lookout for these little reminders or fragments that gave him a way into seeing how Claude had made his studies of the landscape.
And what's new about this painting? How does Turner make the Claudian model his own?
I think in looking at the picture, Turner structures it in a way that follows Claude's precedent, where you've got a tree dividing the composition about a third of the way across the image. And there's a great recession to a distant hillside. And as the forms move into the distance, they become softer and softer. So this is all very typical from Claude. But the way Turner's painted it, even though it's an unfinished canvas, it is much more broken down than you would get in Claude. There's not quite the same attention to detail. Turner's suggesting things in a more abstract way. And the way his colour moves from the kind of brownish foreground that is typical in Claude, Turner mixes it up in a way so that there's softening of greens and blues as it moves into the distance, and then this amazing yellow in the sky, which is a use of probably a pigment that was only newly introduced in the 1820s. So it is an amazing rethinking of the Claudian model.
Thanks to Ian Worrell. Turner Inspired, In the Light of Claude, runs until early June. You can buy tickets at the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. And now to an anniversary. It was 40 years ago in 1972 that John Berger's groundbreaking TV series, Ways of Seeing, hit the nation's screens. Berger's radical approach to art history made his four-part series quite unlike any art programme seen before or since. Berger used the National Gallery as a key location and focused on several celebrated pictures in the collection, including Thomas Gainsborough's portrait of Mr. and Mrs. Andrews. Leah Caribbean met up with the cultural historian Jonathan Conlin of the University of Southampton to find out what made Berger's approach so different.
Jonathan, we're here in front of Thomas Gainsborough's double portrait of Mr. and Mrs. Andrews of about 1750. It's a work Gainsborough painted when he was about 23 years old, and it's a much loved work in the collection. I was wondering if you could start us off by describing it and then tell us how Berger used it in his programme.
It's a portrait, but it's mainly a landscape. It shows the young married couple at the left, and then extending far to the horizon on the right, a pleasantly bucolic scene of a cornfield, a herd of sheep, several trees. One can glimpse two church towers in the distance, and there's a very changeable English sky up above. Berger began by quoting former National Gallery director Kenneth Clark writing about this painting and describing it in terms of its rural charm, its typically English landscape, emphasizing it as something that we could all share in and commune in as a celebration of our nation's soil. Berger, by contrast, saw it as not a celebration of a landscape commonly held, but as private ownership. And hence, his director, Mike Dibb, when filming a transparency of the painting, added a small note, which appears as a sign above Mrs. Andrews's head, saying, "Trespassers, keep out." He also notes that at the time, the mid-18th century, the penalty for poaching was transportation, and that if you stole simply a potato, you were liable to a public whipping. And to him, therefore, this is a painting not about the charm of a collectively owned English landscape, but about private possession.
And the ways in which he intervenes into images or tries to disrupt the usual context, perhaps, in which we maybe more complacently view them. He does this quite a lot, doesn't he? Could you take us through some of the things he does?
Berger, in a sense, teases us in playing on our expectations of how an image like this will be presented on a BBC Arts documentary. He plays around with our hunger to zoom in on particular details, the tendency of other documentary makers to make their own stories by moving from one detail rapidly to another, by exploiting the emotional effects of laying different kinds of music over it. He also notices the extent to which these ploys have been used already, not in documentaries, but out in the globalized world of advertising by, for example, showing images of this painting being used to sell cars and cigarettes.
And 40 years on, has Berger's programme, with all its ideas, and it seems to be really full, buzzing, full of ideas, has it affected our ways of seeing, do you think?
It's had a massive effect, certainly within what were then new disciplines of media and cultural studies, which is still very popular today. Within art history, it was crucial in kickstarting what became known as the new art history, which really took off in the late 1970s, which emphasized the role of gender hierarchies, perhaps free market hierarchies, and also imperialist hierarchies, which have governed the way in which, say, the Far East has been depicted, the way in which ownership and land has been depicted, and the way in which women have been depicted in the past. New art history looked at a painting like this and did not speak of Gainsborough's development as an artist, did not speak of his use of this or that tone or the genre of landscape painting. It spoke about the role of subjugation of women, the subjugation of the peasants who are invisible. So that was what the new history was trying to do, and it was very much doing it in a Bergerian spirit. One of the things that I think Berger got wrong is that he argued that thanks to television and other broadcast media, which meant that the pictures came to us, he rather sternly says that the age of pilgrimage is over. And yet, if anything, television's effect has been to increase the number of pilgrims traveling, no longer maybe to look in a religious spirit at an original work of art, but certainly to come to, say, the Leonardo show here at the National Gallery. They're willing to stand in line for hours in a kind of collective spirit of veneration.
Our thanks to Jonathan Conlin, who'll be back at the National Gallery on the 12th of May to chair a special event devoted to Berger's ways of seeing. For more information and to book, go to www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for this episode. If you're planning a visit to the National Gallery, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily, with late night opening on Fridays until 9 p.m. Until next time, goodbye.